towards the one, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the only being united with all the illuminated souls who form the embodiment of the Master, the Spirit of Guidance. Amen. So today's class is called Building One's Ideal. And of course, we know Mersha talks a lot about the God ideal, how important that is. And so we're going to kind of sort of swim around that subject today. But the question begins like this. It is said that the Buddha was asked one day by his disciples what he meant by ignorance. And the Buddha answered by describing how a person, how a person was clinging in distress to the branch of a tree in the utter darkness of night. And they didn't know what was beneath them. They had just come to do this. They didn't know whether there was earth beneath them or a ditch or water. And so all night they clung to that branch and they were trembling. And by daybreak, they looked down and they realized they were only a foot away from the earth beneath their feet. That is it's just like so to the point, because how much do we spend time sort of clinging, you know, to things that will never happen or worrying about them, you know? And so this is also about building trust with the divine, the Spirit of Guidance, and not clinging, you know, just being able to, you know, maybe perhaps accept what is or as it is coming. The Buddha further replied, ignorance can be defined as fear, doubt, passion, confusion. And where do these come from? And the answer is, they come from ignorance of the one side of life, and that one side of life is the deeper side of life. And we've had a talk about that in the past. You might want to reference that again, about the deeper side of life. And Mersha says, we may be clever in making the best of what we call the lighter side of life, but that isn't all. And so he's really trying to help us turn the view inward. Mersha also says, life is moving. It is all moving. And the Buddhists would say, it's all the nature of impermanence. We can't cling to anything. Nothing stays the same. It's just as a river passing by us. A river passing by us. And we can't hold on to it, no matter how much we try. It's all just the nature of things passing through us. A person may have riches one day and the next be poor. A person may be successful one day, and yet, perhaps sooner or later, they will meet with failure. And then, of course, Mersha gives us these beautiful teachings about the success and the failure and the failure and the success. That's probably worth, if you want to on your own, going to the databases and looking that up again, because everything that rises comes down. I remember once hearing the Dalai Lama saying, in the birth of everything is the seed of its own destruction. This is just the nature of things. This is entropy. But we don't have to be sad about it. We can accept it and see it as life as it is. Murshid goes on to say that he gives this example. And remember the time he was living, but maybe as ever true today as well. He says, such powerful nations as Russia and Germany, who could have ever thought that they would fall down in a moment? Nations which took hundreds of years to become strong and to build themselves up. But when their time came, their downfall did not take long. If such great powers are subject to falling in a moment, and their whole construction can be broken, if that is the nature and character of life, no thoughtful person will deny the fact that there must be some mystery behind it, some secret in which we would like to find the key. And that's what we're searching for. At least we would like, we should, at least we would or should want to know what life is and what is behind this life, or maybe what's beyond this life, or what's in this life, however you want to state that. So here I just wanted to pause for a moment and work with two wazifa, because I think that these are directing us in a way that Murshid's suggesting with this teaching, and then we'll go further. So this is early on for this practice, but we can revisit it later. So the first one, and we've worked with this quite a bit because it has so many layers of meaning, is Yanur, Yanur. And in this way, we're talking about all the various forms of wisdom and guidance are an expression of Al-Nur, what continues to live on in God when we die is this legacy of light. So maybe suggesting that we become light. And those of you that I've shared with you the near-death experience that I had in India, it was just the most amazing, spectacular, subtle and spectacular, and infinite and calm and peaceful, infinite light. Everything got transformed into that, and I just simply dissolved into it. So this is very affirming to me when I read what continues to live on in God when we die is also a legacy of light. The sacred word that I'd like to pair with this is Hakam, H-A-K-A-M. It's hard to ignore the fact that Hak is part of this, which has to do with truth, Yahak. But in this way, we're seeing it as in its deeper sense and its deepest sense as seeing with the eye of the heart. And Murshid talks a lot about this, seeing with the eye of the heart, hearing with the ears of the heart. And by this, it means the light of God. So we use this light to project onto things and also inward, to get a deeper sense of things. And there's a hadith that's quoted here, and it is to be aware of the penetrating insight of the believer, because such a one sees by the light of God. So it's as if this is self-illuminating awareness or God-illuminating awareness. It's there. Are we tuned into it? So let's just do this wazifa a few times. We're going to say Yanur slightly on the tone, and Hakam is like a little short. It's like the emphasis on the k sound. So, Yanur Ya Hakam. Yanur Ya Hakam. Yanur Ya Hakam. I'm going to pause here, and I'm going to ask our brother and friend Kareem, if you were saying these two sacred words, how would you say them? Can you unmute yourself and tell us, please?
Ya Nur, Ya Akam.
11 times, please lead us.
Ya Nur, Ya Akam. 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 Yal Nur, Yal Akam.
Last time. One more time.
Yal Nur, Yal Akam.
Thank you so much, Kareem. I asked Kareem because, of course, he's come from an Islamic background and is very well aware of these names and perhaps has a better pronunciation than I could possibly have. So I wanted to be sure to invite you to do that, and thank you so much. And now we'll just whisper these names without the ya, Nur. And you could breathe in Nur and out Hakam. Nur, Hakam. Nur, Hakam. Nur, Hakam. Nur, Hakam. Nur, And now just breathing in this wisdom and guidance and this legacy of light, and come with this sense of seeing and hearing with the eyes and ears of the heart. Thank you again, Kareem. Very appreciated. And Murshid Hazrat Anayat Khan's words, those who have studied life and thought long enough about this subject have arrived at the same point as the thinkers who have lived as much as 8,000 years ago. Buddha has said and has realized the same thing that a really wise person would realize and say today. This shows us that wisdom is the same in all ages. We may be evolving or going backward, but wisdom never changes and will always be the same. So this is what we want to tune into, this wisdom bandwidth, so to speak. I want to tune into that. Not be like clinging to the branch. We want to breathe and tune into that wisdom. The same realization will come to all those who think deeply and try to realize what life is. What is it? What is it? Why are we given this life? What a beautiful thought to think about the gift of this life and our purpose. And never forget what St. Teresa of Lisieux said. And it was said by Mother Teresa as well. We may not do great things, but we can do great things with love. We can do small things with love. Thank you. We may not do great things, but we can do small things with great love. And so that's very important to realize, that the simplicity, I mean, the saints have shown us their saintliness through their simplicity and their gentleness. So remember that. We don't have to be in a big auditorium doing anything. We can just be in our simple life with those that we love and those we serve. So keep that really close to your heart and in your mind. It is not necessary for us to be great or good, pious or spiritual. The first and most necessary thing is that we become observant. And this is something that I've brought to the for many times, talking about this penetration, sort of developing this deep, deep way of looking at things. So we just become observant. We should look at life more keenly than we do, instead of living superficially. And I'm not talking to any of you, because I think you all understand this very well, but these are Mishra's words and still remain to be contemplated. It would cost us nothing. It only takes us away from our everyday occupation for a few moments and a few minutes. It's very simple. And if practices become too arduous to do at once, break them up into small pieces throughout the day. I take a lot of vitamins, and believe me, I can't take them all at once. They make my tummy hurt. But I can take them if I take them a little bit throughout the day. And so it is with our practices. Just do a little bit. Just a little bit. Remain mindful. Remain observant. Life is always giving an opportunity of thinking, however busy we may be. And Marcia kind of talks about thinking in a different way, and we'll get to that soon. He says, it's not necessary for us to leave our occupation, our work of life, to go into the forest or sit in silence and meditate upon life. We can do those things in everyday life. We can meditate upon life in the midst of life, if only we want to, and it can tell us so much, just to meditate on life, observing things, the nature of nature, the nature of people, the sound of the voice, the quality of the breath, the weather, all these things inform us. Then our action becomes our thought. No, I have to go back. What happens, so he's saying we can meditate upon life in the midst of life if only we want to. So he's encouraging us. But he says this, what happens is that we begin our life by action. And the more active we become, the less we think. Then our action becomes our thought. That's almost like a koan in a way. And I have to tell you, I've highlighted certain phrases of this on this study guide and for our practice, if you wish to do it, but those in our circle, of course, would want to do it, I would hope. Go back and read these sentences and think about them throughout the month until we meet again and see how they're alive in your own life. So I'm going to read this again. What happens is that we begin our life by action. And the more active we become, the less we think. We could replace the word contemplate or ponder here. Then our action becomes our thought. And what this, I think, means that we start to do things automatically without thought, without mindfulness. So Murshid is calling us to be mindful. I'll never forget, there were so many beautiful times I had with my teachers, all of them. And seeing the way they were in the simplest of activities of life, just even the way they would touch a piece of bread and kind of look at it and contemplate what that was before taking it in a sustenance. It was like this beautiful, you know, it was like almost a beautiful dance of hands and eyes and ears and presence. So I think that's what Murshid's calling us to do when we can throughout our daily life. And then he says, but if we consider what exists behind the action and thoughts, which is connected with everyday life, if we can also give thought to the deeper side of life, it would be of more benefit. So to try to look with this penetrating insight, a kind of mindfulness into things, then we're not getting batted around like a leaf in the wind. We can see what that leaf and that wind are telling us. It's beautiful. Every gesture of nature speaks to us. Every person teaches us. May not be what we want to learn, but we still learn. It may come through difficulty, but it's beautiful nonetheless if we let it be. Hazrat Anay Khan, the ideal life is at least to try to live up to one's ideal. But in order to have an ideal, one must first awaken to an ideal. This is a worthwhile consideration. What is our ideal? And has that changed throughout our lives? Or is it something that's everlasting and present? You know, Murshid describes it that the ideal is like going towards a horizon. When we reach it, the horizon moves beyond. And perhaps so it is with our ideal, that as we evolve, that ideal also evolves. Excuse me. Again, Murshid says, not everyone possesses an ideal. Many people do not know of it. It is no exaggeration to say that wars and disasters we have all gone through, and the unrest that all feel, and the disagreement among the people, which is sometimes seen and sometimes not seen, are all caused by one thing, and that is a lack of an ideal. And so it is, you know. We've seen this throughout history. We've seen this in our politics. And it doesn't matter what side you're on, it's there, and we can feel it, and we are experiencing it. Murshid says, we are progressing commercially, industrially, but in all walks of life, progress will be stopped one day or another if the ideal is destroyed. And so in our sphere of influence, it's so important for our inner life to develop that ideal, and it's also important to, in our own way, maybe it's just our presence and our countenance, is to share that ideal, to lift people up in whatever way we can. If there's anything which can be said to be the means of saving the world, it is the awakening of idealism. The first task that is worth considering. And you know, I remember having discussions with Murshid Karim Bash Vidavan, who some of you know. He was an economist. He was the former minister of finance in the Netherlands. He was one of the founding members of the International Monetary Fund. He was the architect of the European Union. And he was always working towards the Sufi ideal in all those things of love, harmony, beauty, and unity. And this he told me with his own mouth and his own heart. He went through many difficulties in his life. He himself, while he was finishing his doctoral dissertation in economics, he was being housed or protected in the Peace Palace at The Hague. They were not allowed to bomb that during the war. And imagine going through all these things and then clinging to this Sufi ideal with all someone must have seen. And then having lost his wife, who was very dear to him, but also, you know, that flight that went to, it was going to Malaysia, that crashed. They never did find it. I mean, his son, his daughter-in-law, and his granddaughter, they were going there as a graduation present for the granddaughter, gone just like that. And he still always maintained a certain kind of calm and equipoise, and I know that he meditated every day. I was in the place where he'd meditate. He had a candle, a little place for incense, a small picture of Murshid on a round table, and he would sit there in that room. And he went through all these things because he had that, he believed so much in the Sufi ideal that that was the thing that gave him courage to endure. So he's a wonderful example in that way. Now Murshid goes on to say, besides for the average person to consider even one thing, that is to live a life of balance would already be of great importance. And so I don't know if there's anyone here that I've mentioned it to, but I know I've mentioned it to some along the way, how important balance is, that we have activity and repose. We have frivolity and introspection, that balance is so important. And Murshid goes on to talk about it. And he says that this is of great importance and it is also not very difficult. When we are working, we should realize that recreation is also necessary. And a confession, this has been a very difficult thing for me because I'm kind of a energizer bunny and very motivated. But as I grow older, I realize, and some that are close to me have said, I'm learning from you. I just try to balance that for myself and realize when I'm fatigued, not keep pushing. It's not good for our nervous system and it's not good for our consciousness. So when we're working, we should also realize that recreation is also necessary. When we tire, it is necessary to take repose. When we think too much, it's necessary to rest the mind at certain times, during which we must try not to think. So meditation is good. Thinking about the vast blue sky and just focusing on that in our mind's eye, like a child sitting on the ground, looking in the infinite blue sky. Or on the surface of water. Try not to think too much. It can exhaust us. He said, but life is an intoxication. We all know that. It's like a drink. Whatever be our motive, whether we're compelled or thrown into it or not, it is all an intoxication. Going about our object with all our might and thought and feeling, till either we accomplish what we want or we've destroyed it. So that's another interesting, powerful statement. You know, in one sense, it's like keep that goal, keep that ideal. Or maybe I could explain it this way. I remember one time Karuna Mai said to me, When you feel like you're breaking bricks in life, you can be sure you've lost your contact with the divine. Can you absorb that? When you feel like you're breaking bricks in life, you can be sure that you've lost your connection to the divine. And so when we're struggling or we're working too hard or we're pushing too harder, remember that. Tune back in. Look for the inspiration within. Don't push too hard. Don't break that ideal. Don't break your rhythm. Keep your balance. Very important. If we used balance in everything we did, we would find the key to a life of greater happiness. Balance. Let's try. Think about that this week, this month, and do go back and read these bold parts in the lesson. Murshid says, people often fight and argue and discuss. Over what? Over a reason. We see this happening today. And perhaps it's over politics. Best not to dispute. When two persons dispute, each has a reason. Each thinks their reason the right one. They may dispute for years and yet arrive nowhere because the reason of each is different. Therefore, to think more is to see behind the reason. So, why is someone so attached to this reason? Why are we so attached to our reason? What's behind that? I mean, when I think about it, I realize if we take the subject of politics, I realize that some people are merely conditioned their whole life from the way their parents and their parents' parents thought about politics. And they've inherited that view and they merely accepted it, but they haven't looked deeply into it. And so we could easily argue with them, but there would be no reason for it. It would just create disharmony. Just accepting it is okay. I have two things to share. So there's someone that I consider a friend, and she's very attached to a point of view of politics and has a litany of things that support her political view. And I said to her, I think that I must feel differently than you do about this, but that doesn't mean we can't disagree, but there's no reason to argue. We're both entitled to it. And she really wanted to argue. She goes, I'm so tired of that. I want to discuss things. And I said, I don't think any good will come of it. Let's remain friends. That's one. And we have. We have. She let it go, and we really have a great time together, but we have very different points of view. And then another man that I've met, I meet a lot of people on my walks, and my dogs, Parker and Kelsey, have been great door openers to meeting people. There's this man, we've had the best conversations, very kind, very considerate man, very friendly. And then one day it got on the subject of politics. And again, the whole litany came out. It was like this fact sheet that was being reviewed before me. I just smiled. And he stopped himself because he realized, I'm not getting agreement or disagreement here. And I said to him, you know, I'm a person from higher education. We think critically. We tend to be a little more liberal. He was shocked because he thought for sure I was going to be in agreement with him. And then he said, oh, best not to discuss such things and remain friends. So, you know, we came to that. I don't know if those are good examples for you, but maybe they are. And if I talk too much, forgive me. So again, Murshid says, therefore, to think more is to see what is behind the reason. At the moment we've begun to see behind the reason, we will look at life quite differently. Then we find that behind what we blame each other for, there's perhaps something to praise. So, if someone has a different belief, who am I to say I'm right? Perhaps they are too. Maybe I can look at that in some way. You know, we're always able to learn. It's sort of soften the edges, okay? And then he says, we shall begin to see that what is beyond all appearances and what we will and that we will get that will give us proof that the whole of life is a kind of unfoldment. So things can happen more gently. instead of with confrontation. I'm also not saying be a doormat. It's okay to walk away, say this is enough. So I remember Mirshad Adayat talking about that. I don't know, maybe it's in one of the things he did on video for us a long time ago, but how important that is to be able to also have clear boundaries. The deeper we look into life, the more it unfolds itself, allowing us to see more keenly. Life is revealing. Life is revealing. So I want to stop here because you've heard me say it 100 times, perhaps even 1,000, this quote by Ibn Arabi, and it's so beautiful. And Ibn Arabi was a teacher on the Sufi path, and he emphasized the importance of seeking to know a deeper truth behind the apparent realities of life. And the quote is, "Seek to know that which transpires behind that which appears. Seek to know that which transpires behind that which appears." And this one statement calls into question, what are we doing here today in our life? What are we doing with our practices? What are we doing with our life? Are we seeking deeper truths, or one could say deeper understanding behind the apparent realities of life? Or are we like a person that Buddha talked about, clinging in utter darkness to the branch? We can choose. Well, my prayer is, and I'm not done yet, it sounds like I'm winding it up, but I'm not. But my prayer and my hope is that we're looking at the deeper side of life and seeking on insights into our spiritual journey, individually and collectively, and the transformation and the evolution of our own consciousness. And that would be such a great gift for all of us to have and to share and to help each other with. And in doing so, I pray that we're coming to think more clearly, develop spiritually, live more peacefully while appreciating beauty. Never forget beauty in all its aspects. Beauty. Now, Mirshad's words. It is not only human beings who seek. If only the ears can hear, even plants and trees and all of nature speak. Are we listening? In the sense that nature reveals itself, reveals its secret. There's only one holy manuscript. That is the manuscript of nature that can illuminate the mind of the reader. In this way, we communicate with the whole of life. Then we're never alone. Then life becomes worth living. Even if we are alone, we're in nature. It's our companion. Now, Mirshad doesn't tell us to go into nature, like the sages did of long ago, but it helps a little bit to take some time in nature. Mirshad says, "The thoughtful of all ages have considered the source of creation to be one and the same. A scientist will tell us today that the cause behind creation is motion and vibration." If you look into the mysticism of sound, that text of Mirshad's, or the mysticism of music, it's all there. He's saying, telling the same thing. But if from motion and vibration this manifestation has come into our view, then that motion is not lifeless. Here he's getting into the new physics, what the physicists nowadays are telling us. And he says, if that motion is life itself, then it is intelligent. That very motion and vibration has its own intelligence and place in this cosmos. It is, of course, not intelligent in the sense that we understand the word. We know the limited side of it. We call it the function of the brain as intelligence. We say that one thing is intelligent because it's living, and another thing, where we do not distinguish it, had to have life, we call it unintelligent. And he says, but an Indian scientist has pointed out that the trees breathe. We know that, how important trees are to our environment and our life. If that is true, then the trees are living. And if today it was proved that trees are living, it would also be found that stones are living. And I have to tell you, I remember, I've really studied many paths, and one of them is the Native American one. And I've had the good fortune to work with medicine men and medicine women. And they always tell me, because I'm always, I don't know about you, but on my walks or when I travel, I'm always attracted to some indigenous stone of that place. And I've collected them. And they've always reminded me, don't ever bring a flat stone home, because that flat stone in their, cosmology and belief system, it wants to stay there. It's sedentary. They said, however, if a stone is round, then it's willing to move with you. And that one you can pick up and bring home. I mean, so lovely to think of that, to understand that something that seems inanimate is really has its own kind of will, or presence. So I share that with you. Let's see. And if today it is proved that trees are living, it's also found that stones are living. Then one will realize that all of life comes from one source, which is the very life of all things, the very life of all things, not just us, not just birds, not just trees, not the very life of all things in this all-pervading space of life. Isn't that what Mircea says in our healing prayer? In the all-pervading space of life. Then one will realize that all life comes from one source, which is the very life of all things. And not only life, but intelligence also. This is what religion calls God. This is what religion calls God. Okay, let's see. We have a little bit more. Now, Mershon's getting into some teachings of Rumi here. Super thirsty today, excuse me. Rumi's life shows a great phenomena and lesson at the same time, that an intellectual could be as devotional as Rumi was. And there's a couple of people in my life that I've known that really would be self-proclaimed atheists, and yet they reach a point in life where they really do realize there has to be more than this, that just belief in oneself and in one's mind and one's accomplishments is not enough. So that one is what Mershad is telling us here, that an intellectual could be as devotional as Rumi was, that how important that was. He says, most often there's intellect and devotion is missing, or there's devotion and intellect is missing. But in the life of Rumi, we see the example of intellect and devotion in the same measure. Balance. Remember the word earlier? Balance. Rumi was the most educated person of his time. Rumi was a statesman, a politician, a man of law, and a man of letters, and at the same time, so simple that when he first saw Shamsa Tabriz, the one who was to be his murshid, he said, God, whom I've worshipped all through life, today came before me in the guise of a man. That great devotion in an intellectual man, and Mircea puts exclamation point, that great devotion in an intellectual man. Here, a simple dervish comes to him, scantily clad, and appreciates him. No, let me go back. I missed something. I'm sorry. Here, a simple dervish comes to him, scantily clad, and the leader of the city, a man of position with power and authority, listens to him like a child, a simple child, and appreciates this man known as Shamsa Tabriz. By Rumi's ideal, he raised Shamsa Tabriz to that stage where a really devoted murid raises their teacher. This shows the ideal and the intellect both together. Yeah, I don't know, David. I know you've had a chance to be around Murshid Hidayat a lot, but he said many times, he always showed an appreciation for, those who were devoted to him and to the Sufi path. And he always said, and then these are his words, quote, "My father always said, it's the murid that makes the murshid." Do you remember him ever saying that to you? Yeah, and that's exactly what he's saying here. By Rumi's ideal, he raised Shamsa Tabriz to that stage where a really devoted murid raises their teacher. This shows that the ideal and the intellect both together, they can go both together. And so, as Hidayat said, I just remember so clearly, I get the goosebumps. Makes me want to cry. It's the murid that makes the murshid. And I hope that we try to be good murids like that. That was the thing that I think uplifted Murshid Hidayat, that we would try to be good murids and good representatives of the message. Rumi's teaching is that God can be the best understood by not thinking that God is in heaven, but by recognizing God in all of manifestation. In other words, bringing heaven on earth and raising earth to heaven. And we have this in the Lord's Prayer. I think all of you probably know it. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. There it is. There it is. Recognizing God in all of manifestation. In other words, bringing heaven to earth and raising earth to heaven. Rumi is the first mystic who does not inflict or impose upon people a forced renunciation or asceticism. He was the first mystic who came forward in the world and said, "The essence of spirituality is the quality of the heart." The essence of spirituality is the quality of the heart. No mystic will ever say it as Rumi has. He goes on further to say, "Whether you love a person or whether you love God, at the end of your destiny, you will be brought before the throne of love." Whether you love a person or whether you love God, at the end of your destiny, you will be brought before the throne of God. And he says, Murshid says, this is more daring of Rumi to have said this because, especially at the time in reign of theology, when one could never say such words, Rumi had the courage to say that. So the whole thing that he's trying to say, in essence, is it's love. And I keep thinking over and over again, I don't know why I've said them so many times, but it becomes so important to me to think about everything in Murshid's sort of ideology begins with love. And from love, it moves to harmony. And from harmony, it moves to beauty. And those words, why he chose those words is really very important for us to consider. And here Rumi is saying, it's love. It's the path of love. Yeah, it cuts through all the theology. It is the path of love. Okay. Let's see what's going on here. I'm not able to scroll down. Well, I'm getting very close. So, guess what? That's the conclusion of the class. I did it in less than an hour. I had a whole other section in there, but I'm keeping it for another class because it's so beautiful. I've had this discovery about Jesus at the grave of Lazarus and what his words really meant. I'm just like, wow. So I'm so excited about that. But that's for another time. But anyway, for our next month, those of you that want to do this and join together, remember, we're like a big mala, a rosary. When we do our practices, we're doing them collectively, perhaps at different times, but everything exists in the realm of vibration and we interconnect. So we'll use Yanur, Yahakam. And then I am asking you to print this study guide. And maybe look at the bold print again and again and try to study that deeply and see how that might influence you over the next month. And of course, I'm always very grateful for any little contribution that you can make. Our prices for everything keep going up. I don't know. Anyway, that's just the way of life, and I have to accept it. And if one day we have to figure out another way around informing people what we're doing and publicizing things differently, we'll figure it out because it's getting quite costly. But if you can, you know, many of you already give a monthly contribution, and I so deeply appreciate that. That was my little public service announcement and push for things. And always know, you have my 100% guarantee. This only goes to help spread the message. And even when people ask me to give lectures and want to give me money, I say, no, can you please? I give you a website, you can donate here. So I don't take any money for things, even lectures that are more academic here. I always say, you can donate here for me. So I keep trying to contribute in my own way as well and help support us. So, shall we first of all remember how unbelievably fortunate we are to have this time together, to have electricity that works, that we have a capability of communicating with each other, where in so many parts of the world, either the grid is ruined or they're not allowed to communicate openly and freely. We are so blessed in that way. We have homes that keep us safe, we have food, we have clean water. We must remember those that don't and offer it when we take it and experience it. I offer this for the benefit of all beings. This is a great aspirational prayer. When we put our heads down on our bed at night and we feel some measure of comfort, knowing that we're not being bombed or we're not having to go to a safe room or whatever, how fortunate we are. These are little ways of being so grateful and enhance the beauty of our life, just to be mindful of this. And we can close with the Katu. O Thou, who art the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the Lord of heaven and earth, open our hearts that we may hear Thy voice, which constantly cometh from within. Disclose to us Thy divine light, which is hidden in our souls, that we may know and understand life better. Most merciful and compassionate God, give us thy great goodness. Teach us thy loving forgiveness. Raise us above the distinctions and differences which divide men and women and us from everything. And unite us all in thy perfect being. Amen. So when I was in the Netherlands, thank you so much, Scott. This one woman, she taught me this. She said, these are the wings of the heart. She'd always greet me like this, and she'd put these wings of her heart right there. So that's a sweet little gesture. And remember the wings, you know, only a heart with wings can fly. Only a heart with wings can fly.
That is the sign language for butterfly.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Yeah, because butterflies are so very special. Yeah, thank you. That's good to know.